As journalism became more influential, so politicians battled to control it. Journalism was always about power. Power over information, holding power to account, or providing propaganda. It claimed to make and break careers, swing elections, and even start wars. It's produced heroes who have revealed scandals such as systematic child abuse by paedophile priests. It's also created monsters who ruined lives and broke the law, such as the journalists who hacked into people's phones. Now it's all changing again. Automatic software programs are writing bot journalism. Citizens broadcast on their phones. Algorithms created by huge technology companies shape the flow of news as people like or retweet the facts and opinions they want to share. That's meant an explosion of content, a tidal wave of information, much of it false, furious, and fractious. People are confused about what to trust, uncertain what is true, fearful of the anger, conflict, and bias they find online. We're in an age when populist leaders and shadowy interest groups use the cliché fake news to attack journalists and deliberately mislead the public. So why did journalism fail to see all this coming? Do we even need journalists anymore?
Welcome to Technology and the Future of Humanity by Dean Anand. My name is Anand Anandalingam, and I'm a professor of management science at the University of Maryland, and I've been the dean of business schools in two prestigious universities, the University of Maryland and Imperial College London. One of the industries significantly affected by emerging technologies such as social media, artificial intelligence, and data analytics is journalism. In countries as disparate as the United States and India, a majority of the public receive their news from social media without much fact-checking by thoughtful journalists or editors. Governments around the world have used these new technologies to speak directly to the public, and they would like to influence and attract their voters in ways that we have not seen before. They also use this technology to punish journalists and academics who do not necessarily agree with their version of the truth. So humanity is perched on a precarious cliff because without having properly informed public, democracy and human rights could be in real danger. In this episode of Technology and the Future of Humanity, we have the privilege of talking to Dana Priest, who is a celebrated investigative journalist at the Washington Post for more than 30 years, and is the John S. and James L. Knight Chair in Public Affairs Journalism at the University of Maryland's Philip Merrill's College of Journalism. Dana has won several Pulitzer Prizes. In 2006, she won a Pulitzer Prize for a report on secret black site prisons and other controversial features of the U.S. government's counterterrorism campaign. In 2008, Dana won a second time, along with the Washington Post colleagues, for exposing mistreatment of wounded veterans at Walter Reed Hospital. Dana Priest has also won the George Polk Award three times, first for reporting on the secret CIA detention facilities, the second one in 2011 on Top Secret America, and more recently, just this year, for reporting on the Pegasus Project that found military-grade Israeli spyware intended for tracking terrorists and criminals, also used by authoritarian governments to hack the smartphones of journalists, activists, and business executives around the world. In 2005, Dana Priest founded Press Uncuffed, a campaign to help free imprisoned journalists throughout the world. A very warm welcome to my friend Dana Priest.
Thank you, Anand. It's a pleasure to be here.
But the type of work you've been doing over the last more than three decades in journalism has been unbelievably fantastic. I'm very proud that you're here with me. And of course, in this period, as we all know, technologies have really come into the fray, and things like social media, artificial intelligence, and of course, the availability of high-speed networks and powerful computers, the internet, have completely impacted journalism in both, I presume, a good way and also really, really challenging ways. So have these technologies made your job easier or more difficult? Can you talk to us about this?
Both. First of all, it is an honor to be here, not only because you're my friend and a genius, but also because this question is so vital to all of us now, this whole question of technology and how it's in many ways running our lives and dominating our lives. And that's certainly true for journalism. Just to give you like the top line is that at one point in 2008, when the market for journalism crashed, technology was both the reason for its crash, because that was the internet and we no longer had a monopoly on information or even our reach, especially not our reach to readers. But then it also saved us at that time because we believed at the time, and I'll never forget Don Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post, urging us all to get Facebook pages because we thought that social media was going to be the new platform for us. And we were literally making deals to give away all of our intellectual product, our journalism, to Facebook. Please take us, because this was how people were getting their news. And then if you fast forward to 10 years after that, when the market had destroyed many newspapers and other kinds of media outlets, it also ended up taking our revenue stream.
Yeah.
For no cost at all, for no revenue to us. And so now we find ourselves in this terrible situation where most people get their news through Facebook. And even though they're reading the Washington Post, they don't necessarily know that because someone circulated it or their algorithm has given it to it. And they're not paying us for that product. So, and then we have this, what I think is an existential threat to democracies, which is the power of social media to brainwash people without their knowledge. And I find this particularly troublesome because, like many technologies before, the technology is way ahead of the legislation, regulation by government or by society to understand the harm that it is doing at this moment. And so I do think, I'd like to talk about that more, but it is an unregulated industry. It says itself regulates itself, and that's because of a particular law that was passed in the beginning of the internet age called Section 230.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about the government and the Section 230. Of course, on the one side is the First Amendment, which says that, people should be able to speak freely and say what they want to say, even if what they say is controversial and so on. But I think people probably didn't think about the fact that what they're saying is not necessarily only controversial, but it's also made up stuff. So they are making up facts about a whole variety of things. So this infamous thing about Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party, involved with pedophilia. And so that is where the journalists provided such a fantastic filter, if I could use that word, for real data, for the truth. So how does a government like the United States government deal with this kind of conflict between the First Amendment, which has to do with free speech, but not necessarily have to do with free facts or free data, and how they help somebody? And the question is it should be journalists from the Washington Post or some watchdog in the government help to filter data?
Right. That's such a key and difficult question to answer. But I'd like to start first by saying the First Amendment protects so much speech, but not all speech.
Mm-hmm.
And we really should focus on the part that it does not protect, which is dangerous threats. We all use the version, if someone cries fire in a theater and as people are running out, they get trampled, right, and there's really no fire, is that person liable for something? Well, I think that's what we need to focus our attention on. And we don't want government regulating who's necessarily speaking the truth or not, because the First Amendment protects false speech.
Yes.
But it doesn't protect threats that create an imminent danger. Now, it's not just, even if the government said, all right, this is how we're going to describe imminent danger, the scale of social media now is so large that the government couldn't police it. That's where social media companies not only have to police it, but they say right now that they do police it. And they have their own standards, which are supposed to be, which are public, the community standards. But the fact is they do not police it. And it's not because they are lazy or what have you. It's actually because, and I've done a lot of work on Facebook in particular, they make their most money off of the most emotional and often not true information. And that is because what they make their money off is advertisement. Right. And it is known, it is well known that I will stay on a website that is more emotional than clearly not.
Right.
Because I'm a human being with emotions and I'm driven to that. And they feed me that. Their algorithm, their business model is built on feeding you emotional content.
Right.
So they don't police themselves nearly at all. They don't police themselves as much as they claim to, especially outside the United States.
Yes.
Where 90% of their market is.
Absolutely. Facebook, of course, has all their value systems and all these things, you know, up on their website about, you know, what they really would like to do and how they want to help society and so on. And of course, there are, you know, as you know, the most recent whistleblower who spoke about how, you know, they have algorithms. So we are back to technology, unfortunately.
We are.
there are these that can kind of figure out how sticky the audience is going to be at different websites. And as you said, the more passionate the website is, the more sticky they are. In fact, to the point where, back to technology, they have decided that they are not so interested in this word like. They are much more interested in emojis that, you know,
right.
Show a certain level of passion and so on. So this goes back to what you said about Section 230, right? Because part of it is that, you know, we consider Facebook not to be a newspaper or a social media, according to Section 230. We really consider it to be a technology, a platform. And so, you know, platforms immune to, you know, being sued for libel or any of those kinds. So is there a way in which one could deal with that? Because, for example, if you write something that is libelous or incorrect or harmful in some way, so you can define harm in various ways, then a layperson can actually, you know, get a good lawyer and sue right. The Washington Post. And you, I mean, of course, Washington Post has more money, so you end up suing the Washington Post. So is there anything that one can do in terms of Section 230? Where is it heading? I don't really know.
First of all, I would say it's very important to understand that what's happening now, the self-regulation, is not working. So we have given them the benefit of the doubt over and over and over again. And what's at stake is so huge. It's not just what we see in the United States, but in India, for example, or Myanmar is my favorite example, because they were literally in the dark ages during the first 50 years of the military dictatorship. They had no media at all. And then all of a sudden, Facebook got in there very cleverly, and they gave people free phones, which they couldn't afford anyway, with Facebook built into it. And now all of a sudden, the world's opening up. And of course, you're going to believe what you see on this amazing technology.
Right.
But, and they were warned over and over again that this was being misused in order to prosecute a genocide on the part of extreme Buddhists and the government.
Right.
The UN actually said that Facebook had facilitated a genocide in Myanmar. And what happened to them? Nothing. Nothing significant. They said they would change. They did for a while. What change means is putting a lot of people, a lot of money behind people who are going to try to self-censor the terrible threats.
Right.
So going back to, and that did not work.
Can I interrupt you for a second?
Yeah.
So, of course, Myanmar is a dictatorship, you can say, a military dictatorship.
It is now again.
Yeah. But even in a country like India, which you kind of mentioned in passing. India is a democracy, and the democratic forces are also using Facebook in ways I presume certainly people don't condone, but maybe not even expected.
Well, so is the United States, and look how look how Donald Trump, let's not beat around the bush,
right,
used it to foment an insurrection.
Right.
And he used it until he got kicked off by falsely making false claims every day or
right.
like every hour.
I mean, he and his supporters for sure.
He and his supporters and the media that is part of that ecosystem.
So can we speculate a little bit? Because obviously now this technology or this social media, which is, you know, the platform is one part of it. All the algorithms that go into, you know, helping people come to this platform and stay in the platform is another part of it. The algorithm that helps all these people, whether there is insurrection in the U.S. or this attack against the Rohingyas in Myanmar, that they can also communicate with each other and so on and so forth. So is there a way to actually use the same technology to try to control and manage this thing? So I know we are both nervous about governments coming and trying
right.
to mess around with the First Amendment.
Well, I think there are some experiments that could be done to see if they would be worthwhile. One is more transparency over the algorithm. Right now, you can get access to Twitter's, not their algorithm, but their the product in a massive, you can get access to the messaging that people use in a massive way. And academics are doing this all the time to try to analyze, like, what is the actual impact of Twitter in people's lives and in the political dialogue? You can't do that with Facebook because it's a closed system. And many people much smarter than I am want transparency in algorithms. So we know what it's doing.
Right.
So we know what kind of decisions it's making for my life. Because really, you can't tell. And you might think, you know, you just can't tell. So that's the first step, is more transparency. I think another step is transparency over self-regulation.
Right.
So that when they say they do something, right now we just have to take their word for it. And there could be an independent board of, you know, experts that are given, that have to sign non-disclosure agreements and then are allowed to go in to inspect Facebook's processes. This is the same thing that happens on nuclear power plants. We have safety engineers that are employed. They're usually probably from the government. Maybe we wouldn't want to have that because of First Amendment issues. But they go in and make sure that everything is safe and that they're doing what they say they're doing.
Right.
So we do that in most industries. Yeah. We just aren't doing it here.
Yeah, absolutely. We do have audits of different types, certainly on the finances. But it's going to be interesting. So I'm going to take away this concept, this technology audit. I think it's an mm-hmm. interesting thing. I know we are getting a little bit away from journalism,
right.
but nevertheless, that AI, artificial intelligence, and data analytics have been used to advise the criminal justice system about, you know, the amount of sentences that people should be given mm-hmm. to prevent what they call recidivism, meaning somebody who has committed a crime from not being released too quickly so that they don't come back and commit the crime again. And it has been shown very clearly that this algorithm that is advises the system about sentences, but it's documented that they are discriminatory against African Americans much mm-hmm. more. So the reason I brought it up is because, yeah, you're right. We need to look at the algorithm to see what exactly is going on. But in a case that was brought against that particular system, it's called Compass. The judge ruled that you can't look at the algorithm because it's a trade secret.
Uh-huh.
You know what I'm saying? So the company that was producing the algorithm, that is part of their kind of intellectual property right or trade secret or whatever the right expression is. And so that's going to be a little bit of a challenge, right? If you go to Facebook and say, well, we need to look at your algorithm, the Facebook has already a precedent law that says you can't really mess around.
But what if you applied that sort of audit tactic without disclosing the secret sauce of the algorithm?
Right.
In other words, the audit would have certain parameters, certain things it wanted to judge,
right.
and maybe they could come out and say whether they're meeting it or failing it, but they don't have to give away the secret to the algorithm.
Right.
They could have a series of questions to answer instead of that. And let me just throw out another interesting idea. I don't know if it would work in the United States, but in Norway, they have a press panel, an independent media standards panel. So this is used to, police, really, the media. And on that panel, there are no government people. There are very smart and very well-respected journalists. And then I believe there's some lawyers. And then there's a group that are sort of the intellectuals of the country. And they have standards that they have to go by. Privacy is a really big deal there, much so than it is here. And if anybody is alleged to have broken the standards, the case comes before them, and they look at the evidence, and then they often, you know, will give out a fine or something. But the idea of having an independent panel is an interesting one,
right?
Because the last thing we want is for government to decide, you know, which
exactly.
speech.
The same thing. Yeah.
Yeah, we don't want that.
But how is this panel constituted? Who decides who's going to be in this panel?
It is. It was created by, you know, that's a great question because I don't know exactly who began.
So you need some kind of civic engagement there.
Oh, otherwise, it's only civic engagement.
Yeah, yeah. Because otherwise, if the government appoints,
right? No. The government does not get to appoint.
Yeah,
but you're right in that I think it's a decision by the panel itself, or maybe by the administrators of the panel, and they have criteria that seem to be working out.
Right.
So in a very polarized country, you might not be able to get that same agreement, but it's worth it.
Not polarized. As I said, a democracy like India, the politicians try to manipulate and control things. And so if you bring in a panel like this, and I'm assuming it's not only policing the journalists, it should be also policing social media and all these new things that are going on.
Right. And the
public. Exactly. And so if you let the government decide who should be on the panel in a country like India, you're probably going to have it completely a set of biased people who are going to say something like Fox News is fine, they're not making any mistakes, but, you know, let's watch CNN. I'm just giving artificial, not to assume that the U.S. is really bad or something, but nevertheless, you know, there is that power. So it's a really interesting idea, actually.
Yeah.
So we've spoken a little bit about how technology is being misused, right? And I'm going to come to this a very interesting project that you've been working on, the Pegasus project. But before we get there, can we be a little optimistic here? For example, just give you a very personal example, right? I mean, at one time, you woke up in the morning and you read the Washington Post and the New York Times, and you went about your day. Now, even somebody like me, I have access online to Washington Post, to the New York Times, to the Guardian from the UK. I can read a little bit about Little French, so Le Monde. I can read Indian newspapers. And I also get information from all these people who are writing and certainly people who are attacking the Section 230 and so on. So there is a lot of rich information that is only enabled by the internet and the media, and technology.
Yes, there's, for all the bad things, there are, you know, probably an equal number of revolutionary technological advances, the one you just cited, but also our ability now to aggregate big data or to aggregate data into what eventually becomes stories, to look at the world from a big sense as well as a small sense. You know, we can now bring people via video or podcasts or, you know, webcams into the war in Ukraine in a way that it is mind-blowing. Yeah. And so in that way, it shrinks the world, and that should be a good thing. And it is a good thing. Yeah. Now, as a journalist, I'll say it's not always just positive, because I remember when I was covering the Pentagon back in the 90s and in the 90s, we would get woken up in the middle of the night if some other newspaper reported something that was really explosive on our beat, or if a war happened and CNN had the first shot of it during, you know, at 2 a.m., our editors would call us up and they would barely say, sorry to wake you up, can you match this?
Exactly.
But now, I don't know when reporters get any sleep.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, you know, and just to explain, because I get asked this question a lot, the reason why you see so many people's bylines on a story now is because the business model of the newspaper is also based still on advertising. And so they want you to look at their website as many times as possible. And so if they have a new timestamp on the story, you might have been following an hour later, and then you're looking, oh, is there anything different? Well, it's got all those bylines, because if one of those six people comes up with a new fact, then they can update it.
Yeah.
And so everybody's always trying to update. I remember when CNN came on, we used to talk about something called the CNN effect,
right?
Which meant it's 24/7. Now we have to compete with CNN. Well, that was simple. That was those were the easy days.
Right.
Now we're competing with so many outlets 24/7.
Yeah. I mean, just to give you a kind of a personal anecdote here. So, you know, there's this huge crisis going on in Sri Lanka.
Yes.
And so within about 1 hour, somebody sent me a feed saying that the prime minister has resigned. And then within a few minutes, it said that the prime minister has been seen on a helicopter heading to India. Then a few minutes later, it said that the Indian government is giving him refuge because there were all these protesters who are really angry, and he's scared for his and his family's life. And then the next thing you know, the Indian embassy writes saying, no, this is fake news and none of this is happening. So,
and was that the truth? It was fake
news? It was fake news. I mean, because obviously that's the official thing that, you know. Now, of course, I'm assuming that is the correct information.
Right.
Because we never know, because people also manage news now, right? Whether it's true or not, you have to manage the news. So you're right. For somebody who's supposed to be the reporter in charge of keeping track of what's going on, it's not only their report. They have to make sure they can manage everybody else's reports and those kinds of things. So I guess you don't get much sleep.
Yeah. Luckily, I am not that kind of reporter anymore. I'm not on a beat.
I know.
But let me just give you a couple other examples from inside the newsroom of technology and what it can do. We have now people that have titles that sometimes I can only guess at what that means.
Yeah.
But for instance, we have a team that is specialists on what they call search engine optimization.
Yeah.
And what that means is the headline getting picked up a lot?
Yeah.
And so headlines will change because we are competing with everyone else, and we want Google and the other monopolies to pick us up and put us up
at the number one link. Yeah, exactly.
And then we also have people that do nothing but what we call audience engagement, which can mean a lot of different things, but partly what it means is repackaging stories to go on Twitter, on Instagram, on TikTok, on something Yak. And now we have a TikTok star among us in the Post.
Oh, really? Yes, yes, no doubt.
Who, you know, takes serious news and makes it a little wacky, and he's very popular. He's probably more popular than someone like myself, you know, who's been there 30 years.
In terms of popular in terms of, people measure that these days. Again, so we are really in this kind of slightly surrealistic world, because you're measuring popularity. Unfortunately, that means ad revenues and a whole bunch of things based on, you know, is somebody clicking on something and watching it for a few minutes.
Well, and if you're a reporter trying to make it through the day getting information, right now you have to spend a large amount of your time tweeting things out, answering other people's tweets.
Right.
You know, you have a social media presence now that I didn't have to worry about back in the day.
Yeah.
So, and then I want to call attention to one other thing, because to me, it's been one of the most remarkable advances, which is forensic visuals.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of deconstructing an event with social media and with taking imagery that's now available from satellite companies and triangulating it all and putting together a picture of what happened, say, on January 6th, which the Post just won the gold medal in the Pulitzer for.
Yeah, I know, today, right?
Yeah. It was the reconstruct of the moments of the months leading up to it.
Right.
But then of the event itself, where you have these just fabulous analytics, visual analytics that show you. They're ahead of law enforcement in many ways, because law enforcement can't do everything that we can do with the visual and reaching out for information that they need special
So that's a good thing, right? That's
great,
a good thing.
Because
now you can, as you say, triangulate information from satellites, from somebody walking around with a cell phone and actual reporters and...
Well, the New York Times won a Pulitzer for international reporting in this amazing series of stories they did documenting the deaths by drone strikes in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And found thousands of more deaths than the U.S. government might have known or at least did not confirm.
Report, yeah.
And they did it with a combination. The best combination is to have reporters on the ground with the imagery overhead.
Right.
And then, you know, sometimes the imagery can tell a reporter where they should go and talk to relatives or go look at a crater site. And so it's fantastic.
So there's a lot of information that is being put out there. So I'm wondering whether, so I'm assuming that's a good thing.
Because I think
now
it's
have
a great
lots
thing.
Of, the technology allows us to do a lot of things. Has it made the life of reporters a little easier? Because now you can actually get access to a lot more information, including background stories and something about the person and so on.
You know, I don't think it necessarily has. And I say that because as the technology has enabled us to do more and more things, the demand for us to do those things on a regular basis increases. Meanwhile, part of our time is taken up on social media, on our headlines, on things that we never had to worry about before.
Right.
So
you have to still do your job, but also do all these other things. That,
Okay. And our job can be, you know, much richer because of the other things. So I'll give you just a very clear example. When we did this Pegasus project that you referred to, Pegasus.
Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah.
I was wanted to talk to you about
that. It's a spyware private company in Israel, the NSO group, a spyware that they say they created to help law enforcement break into encrypted phones. Very difficult problem of terrorists or alleged terrorists and criminal organizations. So who would be against that?
Right.
However, the truth is that it's for sale by to almost any country. They say they deny sales to certain countries, but they won't tell us who. And what we found is, lo and behold, a lot of authoritarian countries are using it not just against terrorists and criminals, but against political oppositions, especially pro-democracy groups.
Right.
So,
But even in India, it's the biggest market for...
And India, yes, that's terrible. They against human rights activists and journalists in particular, but also opposition politicians.
Right.
And so the power of this is huge because it can get into your phone without you clicking on anything.
I see.
So if someone just sent, if the owner of it or the leaser of it, the government sends you a text message or an email or WhatsApp, you don't actually need to respond to it at all. It's now in your phone, and it takes over your entire phone, including the microphone.
I see.
It can go back to all the photos that you deleted even.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Really?
Okay. And it downloads it all, and it can be persistent, which means it is doing it 24/7, as long as it's not kicked off. And if it is, it sends a signal, and they can redo it.
Right.
So there were many journalists who were targeted, and then there were many human rights activists. Morocco seems to have been a particularly user of this. They actually targeted the French government.
Right.
And then after our stories broke, the French government went and investigated, and they keep coming out with new revelations of new ministers and officials who were targeted.
I see. You know, this professor from Harvard Business School, she's retired, Shoshana Zuboff, and she has this book called Surveillance Society.
Surveillance Capitalism.
I'm sorry, Surveillance Capitalism. That's exactly right. And she has been talking about this for some time. She has not looked at the Pegasus project per se, but it is true, actually. So technology, you know, is kind of can follow us everywhere.
Worry about that?
Yeah.
There are also things installed in billboards that are called pixels.
Yes.
And if you drive, if you have an Apple,
right,
and you drive by a certain billboard,
yeah,
it pings your phone. You don't get any message. But now the marketing side of everything knows that you drove by this restaurant. And let's say you drive, you know, and it has
location.
A geolocation.
Yeah.
But it sends this message to the... Chances are the restaurant has an advertiser. So now the restaurant knows that you went by there a number of times, and they'll start sending you So really what it does in the political sphere, it really, I think, it takes away your free will.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't know, you don't understand, you don't see that any of this manipulation is happening.
Right, exactly.
But it's happening.
I'm also wondering, and I asked you this question, you know, is there a way in which we can use technology to actually manage technology? So that's another thing that's an important thing. But thinking about journalism, and for the next couple of minutes, let's say in 10, 20, 30 years, can you see a big change? Already we know that lots and lots of small companies or journal newspapers or media outlets have kind of died. Part of it is certainly because of technology. Part of it is because we in this country certainly have allowed, we are winking at all this antitrust stuff right now because it's all about capitalism and on steroids at some level. But thinking 10, 20, 30 years from now, where do you see journalism heading, especially with this technology that doesn't seem to abate?
Well, let's talk about a couple different subjects on that. One is I do think virtual reality will change things and that will somehow be incorporated into journalism.
Right.
You know, there's already the scale of some virtual reality cameras are already shrinking. And you can imagine that as such a powerful tool for journalists to bring people to a battlefield, to bring people to a prison cell. You know, can you imagine sitting inside of Nelson Mandela's prison cell?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, things like that. So that's good. Local journalism, which really is in a way the skeleton of our democracy, because, you know, we're very decentralized. We like to have our own say over our schools and our roads and the things that most affect us. That was really killed off by social media because of advertising. So they haven't figured out any other way to make a lot of revenue. I think, so this is an editorial comment, I think someone needs to sue Facebook, like a collection of small newspapers, to get back that advertising revenue somehow. And I've said it in a very simple way, but I think there could be a case made that, you know, it is killed off small papers, and it really has, social media has, and by stealing the advertisement. And if we really care about, if we understand the strategic value of an accurate press,
right,
to inform us, then something like killing off local newspapers is not just a business decision. It's a crime against the fundamental backbone of our democracy. Mm-hmm. So no one's going to think of it really as a crime,
right,
but maybe you could think of it as an antitrust issue or something. And you get a sense that the companies kind of think they're headed that way anyway, because they've started giving a lot of money now to journalistic efforts,
mm-hmm,
hundreds of millions of dollars. For them, that's not a lot of money.
Right.
So I do think we need to find ways to hold those. It's not just the company accountable. It's the individuals within the company, the leaders in particular, to equal, you're never going to level the playing field, but to just make it more fair in a small market, to operate in a small market and get some remuneration for your effort.
Yeah, certainly people are not going to know what's going on. And you're absolutely right. Just to add something to what you said, there is a conversation we've had among academics, certainly, about who really owns the data. Because Facebook and many of these social media companies that rely on advertisements cannot really make money off of it without the data that goes in, you know, the kind of profiles that they're creating.
And you're talking about personal, your data.
My data.
Yes.
So you were talking about local data from the local areas for them to somehow get some money back. But I think the data is now the currency of social media. So the question is, we are giving people free data, sometimes not even with them asking. Because as you said, if somebody gets into my cell phone and they use information, that means they are taking data from me.
There are hundreds of people in your cell phone taking data.
I know.
Not, you know,
exactly.
like your furniture.
Exactly.
Example. But we do have a good model to take a look at, and people are looking at it, which is the the European regulation,
right.
Called GDPR. Can't remember exactly what it stands for
now.
But it's very privacy oriented, and it doesn't allow a lot of things that we allow.
Yes.
And why does that exist? It exists because people who lived through the Nazi era learned and probably will never forget that their own information, their private information, was often used against them by the Nazis to, you know, raid certain houses and this and that. So after that, you know, fast forward to when this was adopted, they have very strict privacy rules, and they're based a lot on the past.
Right.
And it is working for them. It's very complicated for the companies, but it seems to be working for them. And we should just know a lot more about it, and the public should know a lot more about it. And the risks, because as you said, everyone loves a smartphone, you know, and you don't associate it with the risk.
Right. Exactly.
But it's a huge risk. And it all goes back to making money. It really does. Like the sale of your data is not taking place because someone is, you know, thinking how to best break your privacy. It's really because people are making money all along the way with your data.
Yes.
And they're figuring out more and more ways to get even finer and finer parts of your data, to the point where they may know, honestly, more about you than you know.
Well, we should end on that note. I certainly think that, you know, the whole field of journalism, already inundated by these emerging technologies, going to continue to be, you know, certainly at the vanguard of trying to help us understand the potentially destructive things that these technologies can do, and help humanity, and certainly help our democracy and perhaps democracies around the world. So thank you, Dana, for being my guest. It's been a wonderful conversation. We could go on,
we could.
For the next hour or two.
But, we'll have dinner to do that.
we need to end it here. So thank you very much, and it was a pleasure to have you as my guest.
It was great to be here. Okay. Thank you.
Next week on Future of Humanity.
So my thinking was, wait a minute, could I use blockchain to just normalize the data across the healthcare system and make everybody aware of the status, simple status of a claim, which we were having so much trouble with? That's where I got interested. So I was more interested in the distributed ledger to solve what I call the non-sexy problems in healthcare of just operations, of everybody being on track and everybody kind of thinking where they are.
That was Dr. Tej Singh Anand, who is a clinical professor of practice at the University of Maryland. Tej has spent his entire career working on digital transformation of various industries, ranging from healthcare to finance. Tej will be talking to us how blockchain is revolutionizing the world of business. You can get Future of Humanity wherever you listen to your podcasts.